Next, we take a look inside the pages of the Washington Post magazine, where we go just about every week for interesting stories about the way we live now. And on this Valentine's Day, a story for men who find themselves intimidated by the prospect of striking up a conversation with an attractive woman. Well, it's not so hard, according to a growing group of men who specialize in the art of picking up women. They say it's not a science and it's not as shady as it sounds. You be the judge.
A lot of people say it's all about going out and sleeping with women.
No, it's not. Well, those are the headlines. That's how you get these guys to come and realize, hey, maybe I need some help.
That's from a video from the Washington Post. They recorded some guys at the Global Pickup Conference, which was held in January at the Holiday Inn Georgetown. You heard the voices of James Norton and Ernesto Gluckman. Together, they run Professional Pickup, a business devoted to putting a little swagger in the steps of Washington's wannabe Casanovas. They are the subjects of a piece written in this week's Washington Post magazine by Ellen McCarthy, and she's here with us from the offices of the Washington Post. Thanks so much for joining us. Happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, happy Valentine's Day to you. Thanks for having me.
How did you get interested in this story?
You know, Pickup has been around for about 10 years now. And so, of course, I'd heard about it before, but then I also had sort of encountered it as a young woman. You know, I had seen pickup artists at parties. I had even gone out with a guy several years ago who, you know, told me he was interested in social engineering. And, of course, I said, what do you mean by that? And, you know, it just sort of piqued my interest. So when we had the opportunity to sort of really dive in and follow these guys and see it from the inside, I jumped.
Wait a minute, you have actually experienced professional pickup artists. This is like a known thing that people really see themselves. What do they wear, like a pin? Like members of Congress wear a pin on their lapels or something?
It would probably be better if they did, then you would know. No, they don't. And, you know, I have to say it's a much more sort of pervasive thing than you would maybe expect. It's not a society and it's not a club, but it's just sort of an underground community that a lot of young men have found themselves turning to in the same way that women turn to Oprah Magazine or Cosmo for tips on how to deal with guys or what guys like. You know, the equivalent doesn't really exist for men, and so they have turned to these you know, pickup websites and sort of underground what they call lairs, which is, you know, sort of a local group of men who kind of hang together and talk about the ways to, you know, attract women.
I see what you're saying. So it's like a Cosmo for guys, except sort of more hand-holding than that. These gentlemen actually run this as a business. People actually pay for their advice.
They pay a lot of money. Yeah. So the professional pickup program that I followed was 4 weeks and it cost $600. Now, some of them are much more expensive than that. So I think guys really need to be careful about what it is they're paying for.
Well, what kind of guys did you see who were attracted to these programs?
It's a mix. Some of them were obviously doing just fine for themselves and wanted to do better and get more women and more women and more women. The other guys really struggled. You know, there were a lot of moments that were sort of painful for me to watch. A guy who was ostracized a little bit in high school and maybe lonely in college, and here it is, you know, he's 28, 29, and you put him at a bar or a party and they would say, okay, go talk to that girl, and he would just freeze.
Did these guys seem to actually help?
I think a lot of the guys would tell you they found some benefit from it. I don't think that they got what they wanted. You know, they thought that they would enroll in this course and then their lives would change and suddenly they would have, you know, a great girlfriend and, you know, this booming social life. And it didn't happen. What did I think of it as a woman? I was sort of conflicted. I thought a lot of it was a little bit appalling and certainly,
like what?
Well, you know, they talk about something called the compliance test, which is, you know, they say it's like a read on how interested a girl is in you. And so what they want a guy to do is give a woman an instruction. And so if she follows, that means that she's interested. So
I got to tell you, that was the thing that pushed my buttons too, which is some random guy you just met saying, hold my drink,
excuse me, follow me over here.
How about go back over to your stool and I'll be right here, you know, waiting for somebody with manners. Hello.
Yeah, I know.
How about manners?
I know.
What, was there anything helpful?
You know, on the other hand, I have to say a lot of it I didn't find objectionable. You know, I thought a lot of what they taught sounded really odd to be articulated out loud, but I don't think in the end that most of it is anything that a guy wouldn't learn watching a really cool older brother. You know, I had guy friends read this article.
Or sister.
That's right.
Okay, because so I would tell them this for free.
But, yes, that's right. And I had a guy friend say, I know this stuff instinctually. And these guys didn't. You know, they just are lacking sort of an emotional intelligence here. And so as horrible as it sounds to hear some of this stuff articulated out loud, I think it kind of helps, you know, approach with positivity, have a smile on your face, try not to take yourself so seriously, you know, be fun.
Here's another one. Clean your shirt.
Yeah.
Ellen
McCarthy. Your apartment.
Clean up your apartment. Yeah. Ellen McCarthy is a staff writer at The Washington Post. If you'd like to read her piece in its entirety, and we hope you will, it's called The Art of Attraction. We'll link to it on our website. Just go to npr.org and click on the programs tab and then on Tell Me More. Ellen, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Finally, it's Valentine's Day, a day when we celebrate love. And even with all that's going on in the world, I think it's important to take a moment to think about our intimate relationships and what we want them to be. So take a minute, if you will, to imagine that you are at a restaurant and you see a man and a woman and she orders, say, French fries instead of a fruit plate, and the man kicks her under the table so loud you can hear it. Do you think that's funny? Or let's say you're at a couple's house and the woman of the house tries to tuck into a bit of lemon meringue pie or a burger, and her partner shoves her face into the pie or takes the burger and shoves a bar of soap into her mouth. Do you laugh or do you restrain him and call the police? I hope you call the police or at the very least that couple's minister, because what you just saw is called domestic violence and it isn't funny. So why is it funny when it's a woman battering a man and regulating his food, and for the coup de grace, hurling a soda can at him because some random woman smiles at him as she sits down next to them on a park bench? You know what I'm talking about, right? What I just described is the scenario for that Pepsi Max commercial that aired during the Super Bowl. Now, many of the media writers and bloggers whom I follow seem to find it hilarious, but maybe that's because they've never been to a battered women's shelter, which is filled with women who have actually had men who supposedly love them, shove their faces into food, and hit and kick them over nonsense like what they wanted to eat. And here's a news flash. The fact that the commercial shows a woman kicking and abusing a man does not make it okay. And don't get me started on the race factor. The couple in the ad is African-American and dark-skinned at that, and the unfortunate bystander who gets beamed with a Pepsi can, a petite blonde woman. Here we go again, that tired stereotype, the castrating black woman, the weak black man, the ultimate object of desire and envy, the petite blonde. Excuse me while I throw up. Now, I know there are some people who want to tell me it's just a commercial and why are you bringing race into it and blah, blah, blah. But can I just tell you, I am not the one who brought race into it. I can tell you, because I have filmed commercials, that nothing about a commercial is random. Every single aspect, the hair, the clothes, the mix of people is considered and debated and chewed over. So whoever dreamed up that commercial, and the PepsiCo press release tells us it was a 28-year-old man from Kansas named Brad Bosley, decided that a black woman needed to be the one to issue a beatdown to her man to keep him under control. Now, let's compare this to the other Pepsi Max commercial shown during the Super Bowl that featured a white couple. That woman is dreamily looking at her date, wondering if he wants kids and is nice to his mom. And the man is gazing back at her, wondering when he can get into her pants. But there's no physical violence. And mind you, PepsiCo is the same company that brought us during last year's Super Bowl a commercial that featured a little black boy slapping the face of a grown man who was checking out his mom's butt. Now, I know, TV shouldn't be that important. TV isn't a babysitter, let alone a parent. But this is the Super Bowl, for heaven's sake, the most watched TV event of the year. Moreover, commercials are aspirational. They are telling us not just who we are, but what we should aspire to. And kids, as we know, watch everything we do. And many kids, and not just black kids, are being raised in homes with no consistent image of what a healthy, intimate relationship looks like. So they're looking everywhere for clues about what relationships are and should be. This is what we're telling them? I guess I just have to conclude that this is what Pepsi thinks of black people. We are people who just can't keep their hands to themselves. So please don't be shocked if I just manage to keep my hands to myself when I pass that aisle in the grocery store. That commercial, by the way, is called Love Hurts. Can I just tell you one more time? No, it doesn't. And happy Valentine's Day. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
Now from cookies to dolls. Ken is getting a digital makeover. Mattel wants us to know more about Barbie's lesser half. So Ken Carson is putting it all out there on the internet. NPR's Shireen Meraji reports that making Ken web savvy is part of Mattel's Valentine's Day marketing campaign.
I'm at the beach in Malibu, California, talking with Ken's contemporaries, surfers Fritz Gerhardt and Taylor Moore.
So are you guys from around here?
Yes.
This is where Ken lives. Did you know that?
Ken lives in Malibu?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
I heard Ken and Barbie broke up or something.
Yes, Ken and Barbie broke up. According to Mattel's senior VP of marketing, Stephanie Cota, it happened 7 years ago.
She did meet an Australian surfer named Blaine, and I think he caught her eye.
But that didn't last, and Mattel wanted to sell more stuff in time for Valentine's Day, so it looked to the web and launched a marketing campaign to help Ken win Barbie back.
You know, he really felt that it was important to get with the times and to get with the program.
For the past 2 months, Ken has been getting with the times by updating his Facebook status, tweeting, and occasionally checking in on Foursquare. That's the site where you share your location with your friends. Erica Swallow follows web trends for Mashable, a social media and tech news site.
On Twitter, it gets a little pushy. Sometimes for a brand, it's difficult to split the line between what's promotional and what's actually interesting.
Ken repeatedly asked his Twitter followers to vote online for whether Barbie should take him back. You could vote at barbieandken.com or text your vote. Mattel also made YouTube videos for Ken. In this one, Ken is creating a match.com profile where he discovers his perfect matches, you guessed it, Barbie. So we've got YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, Foursquare, the Barbie and Ken site.
What do you guys think we're going to do today?
I don't know. We probably have a Barbie mail.
Yeah, let's check it out.
And a reality show on Hulu where hot guys all compete to be the best real-life Ken. Retail analyst Howard Davidowitz doesn't think Mattel is going overboard, and he's surprised he's not seeing more brands taking full advantage of the web.
Look how prominent it is in Egypt. My God, it didn't create a revolution, but it's a key part of it.
Using social media to organize a peaceful uprising and to sell plastic dolls are two very different things. But Davidowitz says, either way,
you have to go where the people are. This is where the people are.
As for the dolls, Barbie and Ken, she took him back, and says Mattel's Stephanie Cota, Barbie went online to seal the deal.
She's changed her relationship status on Facebook. So Barbie's taking this very seriously.
Happy Valentine's Day. Shireen Meraji, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup with anytime, anywhere access for individuals and small businesses. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR.
Tina Brown is back with us once again. The editor of The Daily Beast and Newsweek joins us periodically to tell us what she's been reading, make some reading recommendations. We call the feature Word of Mouth. Tina, welcome back.
Very good to be here, Steve.
And we're talking about a number of readings that have to do with style versus substance, beginning with what seems to be one of the most stylish programs on television, Mad Men.
Yes, indeed. There's a brilliant piece this week in the New York Review of Books written by Daniel Mendelsohn, which spends a lot of time dissecting the visual and content appeal of Mad Men. And at first, it reads like a real slam. I mean, you think this guy takes this show apart. He says the writing's extremely weak, the plotting's haphazard, often preposterous, the characterization is shallow and sometimes incoherent. So it feels like a great takedown of the show. But actually, at the end of the piece, he comes round to saying, okay, yes, it is all about the visual style. But then at the end, he makes a very, very interesting point, which comes around to a different kind of conclusion. He says that the key moment for him after watching all the shows is the scene where Don Draper, the sort of the heartless ad guy who is womanizing his way through the show and living with a wife who is a beautiful but burgeoning feministly angry about her state in the world.
Right.
He pitches a client a Kodak carousel where he shows all, uses his own family pictures to sort of pitch the client on the carousel. And what Mendelsohn tells us is that the pictures that were used in that carousel were in fact the pictures of the author of the show, Matt Weiner, his family life.
Wow.
And he talks about how the moving nature of that scene where Draper shows these pictures of his family, where they're a happy family, which is all a great lie because it's not a happy marriage at all. it resonates because Wiener himself is looking at his own childhood and his own parents, and he suddenly realizes, says Mendelssohn, the writer of this piece, that the view of the people, the grown-ups in Mad Men, is that of a child. The most telling lines sometimes in the show are uttered by a kid who is the son of one of Don Draper's neighbors, and the kid is called Glenn, which, says Mendelssohn, is really the young Matthew Wiener, the author of this show, who is looking at his parents' world with that slightly stereotypical way that children see their parents. And that, he says, is really where the emotional content in the show comes.
So you have this program that in the end he comes around to admitting that he greatly likes, and yet what was in many ways most refreshing for me about this article was that he took this critically acclaimed show and he takes it apart. He points out that, for example, they're always mentioning race and they're always referring to people
exactly.
who are racist, but you never actually have a plot that deals with race. It's always on the surface. It's all style, no substance.
It's all style on the surface. But then he says at the end, you know, it occurs to you that this is, after all, how the adult world often looks to children. Whatever its blankness, that world as recreated in the show feels somehow real to those of us who were kids back then. As for their appeal, who, after all, can resist the fantasy of seeing what your parents were like before you were born or when you were still little, too little to understand what the deal was with them? Something we can only do now in hindsight.
So the style is the substance in the
show
about the early 60s.
Substance, and also the style is what is the only thing the child could comprehend. Kind of brilliant way of looking at it, actually.
Now let's look at a book that you have referred to our attention. It's called Everyday Icon. The subtitle will tell you what it's about. Michelle Obama and the Power of Style by Kate Betts.
Yeah, this is a very good piece by Kate Betts, who was the former editor of Bazaar. And she talks about how first ladies have always used their clothes, really, to communicate to the nation in shorthand. And she says, Michelle Obama is the first lady who is at home in both camps. She's taking Hillary's intellect and dressing it in Jackie's pearls, because she's both a woman of substance, but she's also a woman of style. And she really is unapologetic about being both. So she really has forged a kind of a new way of being a contemporary modern woman of power.
And now it's interesting. This book by Kate Betts makes a statement that some people will challenge, I'm sure. Style is who we are, it says on page 6. It registers both the persona and the person. To the extent that you can know, what do you really learn from the way Michelle Obama dresses?
Well, I think, you know, it is the right statement in the sense that how you choose to present yourself to the world is your choice. And in that sense, it does say something about who you want to be seen as. I think that when Michelle came out in the inauguration in that kind of pale, kind of asparagus gold Isabel Toledo jacket and dress, it was so entirely different from the sort of the bully red and blue Washington power palette that most women in Washington wear. So she was already saying, I'm from a new generation. I'm from a different way of looking at the world. I'm a global woman. And I think she wants to be seen as a global first lady, which is really a new thing for America.
Well, let's go global with our discussion of style and substance here, because you've also sent us something from the London Review of Books. It's a diary entry. That's the type of article that it is here. And it's a gentleman who went to Russia and tried to deal with questions of style on television. What did he learn?
This was a very amusing piece by this guy who went to Moscow to be the development producer assigned to get Russian TV channels to take reality shows and documentaries.
Peter Pomerantsev is perhaps how it's pronounced. What
yes.
happens to him?
Well, what happens is he discovers that, for a start, you know, aspirational ideas just don't work in Russia. For a start, you know, when they try to do this kind of Russian apprentice, the Russians don't actually admire that kind of brash, you know, you're fired tycoon. They actually admire people who kind of operate in the shadows. And their heroes actually are not businessmen at all. They're gangsters. And in fact, you know, Putin actually dresses like a gangster, he says, sort of on purpose, because that's kind of what the Russians really relate to. I guess they know so many of them in business life.
Mm-hmm.
He says that the idea of kind of a meritocratic way of getting a job is just not used. He says the usual way to get a job in Russia is not by impressing in an interview, no, but what is known as blat, which is connections. He said Russian society isn't much interested in the hardworking, brilliant young business mind. Everyone knows where that type ends up, in jail. So it's really very funny indeed. I laughed so much because, you know, in America, we tend to sort of see everything through the prism of us. And that's one of the mistakes that's being made both in diplomacy and in media, is that, you know, you have to go there and realize these are very different places.
Let me raise another thing that is in this article. There's an attempt to put reality TV on. And of course, reality TV is fake in the United States. But there's a degree to which people are at least unscripted with many of their remarks. People can't get over that idea of actually being even that real in Russian television. It's impossible.
Absolutely not. Well, this is a society that has had fake TV put to them for so many years with all the propaganda that goes out. They don't believe that there's any such thing as reality-based programming. They just think it's all completely fake, like everything else they've been ever shown. So it totally bombs. I mean, they just say this is just nonsense, and they all shrug.
Tina Brown, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
The feature is called Word of Mouth. We talk regularly with Tina Brown, editor of The Daily Beast and of Newsweek. We've got more excerpts from Tina's recommendations at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skip.